Welcome to Arizona Quail Today, your go-to podcast for all things quail hunting in Arizona. We're dedicated to educating and inspiring the next generation of quail hunters. A big thanks to our supporters and proud partners, Arizona Outdoor Adventures, Fathers in the Field, and Marsupial Gear. Thanks for tuning in, and now let's dive into today's program.
Hey guys, you're listening to Arizona Quail Today. This is Ryan Rice. I'll serve as your host today on the program. We will have Randy Babb. Randy is a biologist, a naturalist with an extensive knowledge in wildlife, and he writes. He's a photographer, illustrator, speaker, and grew up hunting right here in Arizona. Randy, great to have you on the program today.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, hey, here's what we're going to do today. Those of you that are tuning in, this is our second podcast, and we've already got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of listening going in, which is really encouraging. Randy, we looked on the stats for the email subscription, and we have folks in Saudi Arabia. We have Sweden. Our largest demographic is out of the United States, obviously. Then we have Canada and the Ukraine. So this is a fun international podcast right off the bat. And so, Randy, you've worked with Arizona Game and Fish for a number of years, and you're still keeping busy. What are you doing these days to stay busy?
You know, it's that old axiom. I never knew how I found time to work. Got lots of projects. We've got some reptile and amphibian book projects going, and I'm working on a key for amphibian larvae of Arizona and doing some writing for fur bearer predator book, and then trying to get out and just mess around, do some fishing and hunting. So got lots to keep me in the field and my nose to the grindstone, so to speak.
Nice. Well, today I know that we want to talk about, you know, what's happening right now in Arizona for, you know, quail biologically, and we're going to look at Gambel's quail, scaled quail, Mearns quail, and have that discussion. But to kind of start off, I just thought give our listeners kind of a quick overview real quick. I want to hear a little bit about how you got into hunting, and then we'll go through kind of those quail kind of analysis per species. And then maybe at the very end, we'll take some live Q&A questions. Nate, our producer, is a new quail hunter, and he's taking copious notes. And then we've got maybe one or two other folks that are sending in messages via social media. So let's jump in and tell us a story. Randy, how did you get into hunting? Who got you into it? And maybe what was your first hunt, memorable hunt that you want to share with listeners?
I was raised in a hunting fishing family. My dad was a rabid sportsman, loved hunting just about anything. But of all those things, quail was absolutely his favorite and is certainly far and away my favorite. So, yeah, I a lot of places that I hunted, you can't hunt anymore. Like I remember shooting doves in what would be downtown Chandler right now. And wow. I shot my first quail up on Four Peaks, right off the Four Peaks Road there. I don't think I would hunt most of that country right now because it's, you know, got ATVers and people all over it these days. Yeah, just lots of changes and lots of time in the field, lots of great memories with my father and my brother and very good friends chasing birds all over the state mostly. But I do a little bit of big game. Elk and deer, javelina, turkeys. Love the sandhill crane hunt. Birds are my real passion, far and away.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to hear that we have so many people that talk about really this. They're getting into quail hunting so much as either the father or the uncle. And it's so much kind of a rite of passage or a mentorship program. That's not you take a class or you just, you know, attend an event. It's like a lifestyle.
Yeah, I think And I think that's probably could be said of fishing and hunting in general. You know, you really do need a mentor figure that's going to take you out and show you the ropes, you know, and there isn't a time when I'm out in the field when I don't think back about my father or think, you know, what did he say about this or whatnot. And then there's, of course, a lot of little phrases that, you know, come out when I'm hunting that, you know, my father said to me for one reason or another, you know. So, these things are, I think it is, it's not about killing birds. It's about the whole doing everything.
Yeah.
And all of the things you do outdoors, hunting, fishing, hiking, wildlife watching, whatever it happens to be, it's so much more than the activity itself. It's all these periphery things that look into it. And it puts you in a situation where you're going to see things that you'd see no other way. I mean, there's nothing else I would do where I'm going to sit on a ridgetop for 4 hours behind a pair of binoculars, other than hunting and, or climb, you know, down in these canyons or other things, unless I'm looking for something. And so it's a wonderful way to be out and doing things.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I don't know if I told you this, but, you know, last, season, my 11-year-old daughter was drawn for cow elk, and we went out on a cow elk hunt, and I trained her so hard and extensively, and she bagged about a 600-pound cow elk. And
I saw the photos. It was a magnificent animal. What a privilege to hunt with your daughter like that.
Oh, I know. It was, and this year, I cannot believe it, my son got drawn for cow elk, and then I got drawn for bull elk, both modern gun. And so there's very few things that will take me away from quail hunting, but a bull elk modern gun, I'll do it. I'll do 10 days.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with you on that, but I enjoy elk. I just like hunting, you know. So, I remember my father's friends coming up at his funeral and saying, you know, your daddy just liked to hunt. It didn't matter what it was. He just liked to hunt, and that's pretty much true, I think, of me too.
Yeah. Well, for me, I'll tell you what it is. So I would rather quail hunt than just about anything else. You know, I mean, and it's not just the birds. It's the dogs. And, you know, I grew up like, you know, duck hunting in Arkansas with my dad, just like, you know, what you were talking about. And it was kind of a way of life. And then my brothers, and it was the bridge for our relationship when times were tough. And we would always hunt no matter what was going on in the family. We would always hunt, and we wouldn't always try to fix all the problems on the hunt. We would just focus on the hunt, and that would tend to open up the doors for the relationship. And the dogs were a big part of that, the duck dogs. And then moving out here to Arizona, it's been bird dogs, you know. And that's been really cool, bringing my dad out and hunting with him, and bringing my brothers out and having them explore Arizona quail hunting. So a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, it's quite a legacy that you're passing on to your children too now, and hopefully they'll have the opportunity to pass on to theirs. And so we didn't have bird dogs, so it wasn't until, you know, the 90s or so that I very early 90s, late 80s, I started using bird dogs. And that was mainly because I wanted to start hunting Mearns quail. And so, you know, got into dogs then, and I love my dogs, and I hate my dogs. And so it's just a typical, you know, dog relationship you have with bird dogs. You know, they're the most wonderful things in the world, and the most vile creatures on the planet. You know,
what are you running? I forget. Is it a Brittany and Brittany, or what do you run?
No, I've always had English pointers. And
okay.
So over the years, there's been a few short hairs mixed in there, but I for my money, and I've hunted behind a lot of different dogs, and they're all great. I'm not going to disparage any of the breeds, because all of them have wonderful qualities and do fantastic things. But just for my money, you know, a stylish English pointer on point, you know, is just what, you know, checks the box for me. I just like those dogs a lot.
Yeah, are you still running English pointers right now?
Yeah, I've got four of them, and one is retired, Miss Maudie. All my dogs are named after characters in To Kill a Mockingbird. So I've had so many dogs, we're down to third tier characters now, and so
Did you ever have Boo Radley?
yeah, we had Boo, and we had a Radley, and Scout, you know, Finch, I mean, all those. And so laying in the living room there with my wife is Spencer, who's actually Tom Robinson's dad. And we've got Miss DeBose out there, who's that maniacal lady that sits on the porch and yells at the kids. And
Oh my goodness.
then we've got Harper, because now we're down to the author's name, because we've gone through all of them. And then Miss Maudie's out there too. So I think I'm going to have to move on to Moby Dick, because there's some good names in that book.
That's so good. Well, we're sitting on the back porch right now at my house, and we're looking at a really good English pointer. He came out of Ron Horn's line. Ron Horn, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a dog breeder and has been a bird breeder as well for and worked with NASTRA and Arizona Pointing Dog Club and a few others here in the state. But that dog is 8 years old, and he's a very good seasoned English pointer. Nate just picked him up as a gift from Ron Horn, and the dog's 8 years old, and we're looking at breeding him with Zona. And so we should. I've got two English pointers as well. Zona comes out of Sunshine Kennels, and then Happy comes out of Ron Horn's line. And but anyway, if you're in the need of pups, we may be having some in the next.
I would say yes, I'm in need of pups, but my wife would vehemently disagree with that. So that's
With four dogs, I bet. All right, well, let's jump in. I'm looking at your book here. This is a great book. I've recommended it before to our listeners and folks
Thank you.
online. It looks like an introduction to hunting Arizona small game, and it's got all sorts of stuff in here. And I love it because it's such a colorful book, and it's very well written, and great information in that. And I noticed you have an endorsement on here by David Brown. I know he was a key figure in your life and friendship. Do you want to tell us a little bit about him and the influence he's had on you?
Yeah, so you know, I appreciate the kind words about the book. That's very nice. I, as an aside, I tried to write the book that I would want to find if I went hunting in Idaho or Michigan or anything. And so when I started hunting in other states and I was chasing different kinds of birds, sharp tails and sage grouse and whatnot, I could find very little information that really gave me what I needed to know about hunting them, and just basic stuff like loads and guns and behavior on the birds and things. And so I'd go out there and I'd wander around in those prairies for days, you know, before I was finding birds without having really any idea what I was trying to do. So that's what that book is about, for somebody that's either starting out or really just comes to the state and wants to know how our birds act and what they do. That's and some of the biology. That's what I was looking to do. Dave was, you know, my father taught me to hunt, and I've had, in addition to my father, I had three great mentors in my life, and Barry Spicer, Cecil Schwabe, and David E. Brown were the other three, and they were all biologists that I worked with professionally and took the time and had the consideration to take me under their wing and teach me things and show me things. And we shared the field a lot with all those guys. And Dave was basically a surrogate father for me. My father passed away when I was very early. So Dave and I did a lot of trips to Mexico looking for everything from crocodiles to different habitats to traveling to, you know, the further south point above the tree line in Mexico, all these things like that, you know, just looking at these different things and lots of discussions and lots of research projects on antelope jackrabbits and masked bobwhites and porcupines and possums and anything that interested us. And he unfortunately he passed away just a few years ago, and miss him every day.
Yeah, you know, I remember meeting with you when I had you come out and speak to the Arizona Pointing Dog Club, and you handed me a gift that I'll never forget, and it was a one-of-a-kind copy of Dave Brown's book.
Yeah, that is a phenomenal book, and anybody that's interested in birds, I would really encourage them to get Gay Birds of Arizona, because it's the other end of the book I wrote, which was kind of spanning the popular technical end, and Dave's is heavier on the technical end, but still lots of great information about who the birds are, what they do, what they're about. And you know, for me as a biologist, I don't understand people that hunt and fish and don't want to know about the animals they're after,
Yeah.
because once you learn about them and who they are, what they are, they become so much more than just a bird or a fish or anything. You know, they're these magnificent creatures, you know, sculpted over millennia to be what they are, and they all are so special. Each and every one of them are incredible animals in their own right. And Dave does a good job of underscoring that in that book.
Well, one of the things I think that is helpful with your book is that it's not just, you know, small, I mean, quail. You do cover gambels, scaled quail, Mearns quail, I think California quail. And I don't know if you cover the other ones, but you also cover other mammals for small game and then field to table. You know, can you talk just a little bit about that field to table for a moment? Is that something? Why did you feel like that was important to put in there? I think I know why, but I think just for in your own words, what would you say?
Yeah, I guess I should explain that doing this book, you know, was originally, as I said, the book I wanted to find when I went and hunted in these different states. And then well, I was working with the editor at the Game and Fish Department at that time, and she wanted, you know, she is a fantastic editor, matter of fact, a good friend. She really wanted to see, you know, more of a for somebody who was just starting, how to take them through the whole thing. So that took me some places I wasn't wild about going, because I knew it would be a lot more work. And you know, so part of that is a section on cleaning different game. And you know, and there, you know, the old saying, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Those game processing section in there are the way I do it, but it is not the only way to do it. And there's a lot of great ways to clean birds and rabbits and squirrels and everything. And then, you know, then it was this field the table thing. And I like cooking, and I do most of the game cooking, I think, here at the house. If I, you know, if we're doing quail, I'll usually cook them, or cranes or grouse or whatever we happen to be having. And so a lot of those recipes were my dad's recipes, and he was a fantastic cook. And so that if I'm going to cook quail, I'm going to do it in that wild rice recipe, that the quail with wild rice, just not only for the memories, but it's just a really good solid recipe. And if I'm going to fix doves, I'll more often than not, do them in the foil packs, because that's another super simple way, and it gives you a really great product. And so, you know, there are people there that are great cooks, and I've tried all those recipes. I really like that duck marinade recipe, that's a really good one in there too. And so these are kind of my favorite recipes in that book, but there are lots and lots of other ones that are just fantastic. And I'd encourage anybody that's looking to cook game to do some scratching around and see what they find that might suit their needs best.
Yeah, that's great. On that, is that wild rice recipe in the book?
Yep. Yep.
And is that
And
that's part of your is that does that come from your dad?
that's the way dad would fix them. And
Wow.
so, you know, sometimes I fancy it up a little bit. I'll slice almonds into the wild rice or chop onions into it or something, but it's pretty straightforward. And it's and you know, you combine that with a salad and a cold drink, and you got a whole meal there, you know, quail on in wild rice. And so it's super simple. It's an easy recipe.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. I'm the same way, Randy. I do all the wild game cooking, but you know, when you bag a big elk, and boy, I don't know for your wife, but you know, like when you bag a big elk, it's like, man, you just got so much meat, and she's le really learned how to cook that elk, and then we just use it for like almost like ground beef in a sense, and mix it in. But for quail, it's definitely me and all my kids love quail, you know, and so what is that? That's your favorite? Is that wild rice recipe?
Yeah, that is. Like I said, if I'm going to fix quail, I'm going to do it that way. Grouse and you know, I'll often cook them like that rabbit recipe where you brown them in the skillet and then turn the heat way down low and add a half a cup or so of chicken broth and then just allow them to sit there and simmer, you know, for several hours. That would work well with quail too, but like I said, that wild rice recipe is far and away my favorite
That's great.
one.
Well, I'd like to share this recipe with our listeners. Would it be all right if I put it on either the website or should I just direct them to buy the book?
Oh, yeah, heaven's sakes, you're welcome to share it.
Okay.
Nobody has to buy
All
a
right. Well, and the books, if they do want to buy a book, where do they buy the book? And I would recommend everybody to buy this book just because it does have so much, and it ties into our mission as an organization, Arizona Quail Today, educating and encouraging the next generation of quail hunters. And this is an introduction to hunting Arizona small game, and it kind of highlights quail quite a bit. So, where do they pick it up if they wanted to buy it, Randy?
Yeah, you can buy it either online or at the office from the Arizona Game and Fish Department. And then it's carried on and off through other outlets, but I really don't know where they're, you know, who's carrying it. And I'm always kind of surprised when I see it someplace. But
When you say online, what do you mean by that? Do you mean Amazon or
yeah,
do you mean, what do you mean?
I think you can get it through Amazon, but you can get it through at the Arizona Game and Fish Department. You go to the website, and they've got a publications there, and you'll see that book there.
And there's really no kickback to you on that. So, I mean, unless, I mean, I wish there was, but I don't think so. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't get anything for it. It's you know, I wrote it while I was working for the Game and Fish Department, and so it's, you know, it's theirs. And it was, you know, it was kind of a passion project. You know, I love small game hunting. It's what I do the most of, and so the whole idea was just to help other people, you know, get into the sport and to find out what they need. I mean, the whole thing with loads and chokes and stuff, you know, that's a minefield in itself, right? With when you start dealing with things, and I just assumed every bird in the United States was as tough as a gambler's quail, pound for or ounce for ounce, and that's not even close to true. You know, light
Yeah.
loads work really well on blue grouse, and in fact, I usually shoot them with dove loads, and so you know. You don't want to use number fives on bluegrass because you just don't need it.
Wow.
And so it's that kind of stuff that's hopefully helpful to folks.
Yeah. Well, while we're on it, talk to us about loads. Like, what would you be your ideal load for Gamble's quail, Mearns quail, scaled quail, if you don't mind, and then what do you use? A 20 gauge, 12 gauge, 28? What are you shooting?
And so really like a loads for gambler's quail, you really don't want to use dove loads. They're remarkably tough for their size, and there's actually very few birds that compare with them just far as out and out toughness. I mean, I would rank pheasants and chuckers up there with them, and but as I mentioned, other big birds like sharp tails and sage grouse and rough grouse, Franklin's grouse, you know, they're light load birds, you know, dove load kind of thing. So you want something at a 7.5. And so standard 7/8 ounce of 7.5s out of a 20 gauge is what I often shoot at them. I'll use 28 gauges. I really like that gauge a lot, and are those guns. I use those quite a bit, and I'll use 7.5s again, or a standard load of 5/8 ounce load of 6s sometimes out of that 28 gauge. You know, and so kind of just geared up to the bird, you know, geared to the bird you're shooting. On the other hand, if I'm shooting Mearns quail or Montezuma quail, I'll use 9s out of a 410 or 8s or 8.5s.
Wow.
Just a standard 1/2 ounce load. And that's plenty for that bird. Wow. So
are you shooting it over and under on the Mearns with 410?
Side by sides.
Wow. Yeah, we gotta get out in the field together. That's pretty spectacular.
No, well, yeah. Wait till you see me shooting. You'll be less impressed. But the I'm kind of a side by side guy. Don't really care for over and unders, but I really do like side by sides.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I am a true Arkansas redneck. I grew up shooting a Remington 870 Express 12 gauge for duck, and I have a really nice 20 gauge over and under, and I like it and I enjoy it, but I don't shoot near as good on that 870, and so it makes a little bit more work because I got to pick up shells that fly out sideways. But
sure.
I like to shoot 8-shot out of that 12 gauge, and it's just like I can just hit with it so well. So I'm working really hard to actually spend a lot of time at the range to just get better and better and better. But I really enjoy the over and unders, but I'm just not near as good a shot because I just spent so much time shooting that 870 frame.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you hit on a really important thing. You know, the guns you shoot well are the ones you're going to gravitate to.
Yeah.
And you should use those because, you know, part of our job as sports people are to be efficient. You know, we don't want to cripple things. We don't want things to suffer. We want to shoot, you know, and shoot well. And so we have that responsibility. And guns we shoot well, you know, there's just certain guns that fit us well and that we handle well. And that's me. And when I'm, I was in Africa and, April of last year, and I was shooting spurwing geese and Egyptian geese, and I had a borrowed gun, and I was not much of a threat to those birds.
Yeah,
and it, but
that's
it
pretty
just
frustrating.
Fit, yeah, it just didn't fit me well, and I didn't shoot it quite as well. I mean, I killed, you know, plenty of geese, but the point was I would have been much more confident and felt a lot better shooting, you know, one of my own firearms that I'm used to shooting. And, yeah. and you know, and far as redneck guns, I shoot a really, really, really ugly Browning A5 at ducks, you know, at cranes and turkeys, you know, and it's, you know, there's nothing, I mean, it's an efficient machine, but there's nothing aesthetic about it. And it's a beater gun, but it looks great.
And I think that's a good transition into the topic of, you know, the quail species because, man, I mean, I've talked to a number of guys from all across the state, and they talked about down south how they were bumping into coveys of gambles of 10 to 12 birds, 15 birds. And I'm like, man, all around central Arizona, I mean, I was bumping into coveys early in the season, 20, 30, 40, 50 coveys of Gamble's quail, and I like that 12 gauge with it because it was a rougher gun, and a lot of the terrain, the challenge is where I've been hunting, is it's just harder. It's a lot tougher. It's a lot more. There's a reason why those coveys were bigger too, despite, you know, in addition to good rainfall in our areas, it was, you know, the habitat was It was unfavorable for hunters, and so it created an opportunity for those birds to, you know, thrive. And so we jumped into, we had a really good season for me and my family with Gamble's quail. But let's talk about that for a moment. What's happening right now with Gamble's quail biologically? I've been out running through the Sonoran Desert on hikes with my wife, and boy, I'm hearing them call, and I'm not seeing them as big a coveys right now. I'm seeing them alone calling a lot. I'm seeing maybe some pairs, two or three. So what's happening?
Yeah, so at the, as we close up the bird season here, you know, mid-February-ish, within that covey, birds are already paired by that point in the year. So, and then that covey splits up, and I'm still seeing coveys and sometimes some surprising size coveys, but for the most part, they're shrinking in size, which should be happening as those paired birds leave. And then the birds that are unpaired are those quail that you hear calling. Those are single males, and they're looking for you know, a female. And so one of the interesting things about many, many birds across around the world is that even though at hatching time you've got pretty much a one-to-one hatching rate on most, on many, many of these birds, you know, one male per one female, more or less, something happens where you lose females as they mature. And by the time it comes around to breeding, you end up with, on many species, a heavily skewed population towards males. And so hunters can just keep track in their bags. If you look, more often than not, you'll kill more cockbirds than you will henbirds. And that's because there are literally more cockbirds than there are henbirds out there. And this is true of a lot of ducks, like mallards and widgeons and whatnot. And so the greater discrepancy in the appearance of the birds, the more, or the more different, that's bad English, but the male is from the female, the more males you have to females. Wow. And so Gamble's quail, we have a significant number, greater number of cockbirds than we do have henbirds. And Mearns quail, that discrepancy reaches its greatest disparity between those two. You have a lot more male Mearns quail or Montezuma quail than you do have hens. And then when you get to things like scale quail, where they're almost identical, that margin narrows greatly. So sandhill cranes, Canada geese, swans, scale quail, sharp-tailed grouse, some of those things, that margin narrows quite a bit. And almost down to one-to-one on a lot of those. Yeah. And so so you've got, as the coveys break up, you end up with a lot of these unpaired males, and they're the ones that are out there calling their hearts out. And if you notice, they're running a route. So in my yard, I live out here in the East Valley, and you know, got a lot of desert around, and I have male quail calling from the same perches every morning about the same time, and they run a route. And then they'll do it again in the afternoon. And so they will do that, just call their little hearts out, hoping they're going to get lucky and something happens to one of the male birds out there. The paired birds are sticking together, and they're going to start laying here as we go into this month. And one of the things, if you just sit and watch paired birds this time of year, Gamble's quail, you'll notice they're doing a lot of looking. And so those paired birds are walking around. I was watching some just the other day up near Apache Lake, and they're, you can see them, and they're going under bushes and trees, under all kinds of objects, and they're looking for nest sites. And so they're exploring around. They're going to find a bursage or some kind of shrub that's a good place for a nest, and with overhanging branches, a good canopy on it, and they're going to lay the eggs there. And the female will lay one egg each day, more or less, until she gets the full complement of eggs, which with the Gamble's quail, I think is about 13, 12 or 13 eggs is the average clutch size. And then she's going to sit on them. And then the cock and the hen will raise those chicks up. And so those chicks will start hatching at the end of this month and on into May. And then when you see late clutches, that's usually not a good sign. So it's not terribly uncommon with the drought we've been having to see chicks on into July and sometimes even early August. And those are late clutches of birds. And so those are birds that maybe even lost a clutch and renested or have waited to lay. Some people believe that that's a second clutch, but we really don't have any good evidence of that, that Gamble's quail lay a second clutch.
Yeah.
So we're pretty sure, and this is research that needs to be done, mind you. So, you know, it's not like it's written in stone, but again, we don't have any good evidence of second clutches. One thing that does happen is the Gamble's quail will nest dump. And so you might have two, sometimes even three hens laying eggs in a single nest. And then one female will raise those up, or one pair will raise those up.
So one of the hens just says, "Hey, I'm on the run. I was born for the road, and so I'm going to drop off my babies with you." And then they leave.
I don't know if that's exactly what they're thinking. You know, my wife is the same species as me, and I don't even know what she's thinking 90% of the time. So I dare not, you know, imagine what a quail's thinking. But yes, that happens, and so. This occurs. And then also in wet years like this, and this is a good thing. So we had a wet winter last year, and gamble quail reproduction is all about the rain that occurs between October and March. And so last year was one of the best winter rainy seasons in history. I mean, it was really excellent winter rainy season. Then we had really horrible summer rains, mm-hmm. and now we've got a pretty decent winter rainy season now, even though we're moving out of what we would attribute to the winter rainfall. Anything that occurs to April, from April on, is attributed to summer rainfall, and so is the way it's done. And so, but it still helps quail. So anyway, as we continue with this, the quail actually get vitamin A and phytoestrogens from the plants they eat. So the bigger these plants are, this green stuff you're seeing growing up all over the desert, things like erodium, heron's bill, fillery is another name for it.
Is that little green stuff that's growing on the ground?
it's part of it. There's the thing that's growing on the ground. There's, if you get out there and look, there's a lot of different things. And some of those are great and very nutritious quail foods, and some of those aren't. And so, there's some invasive weeds. One that's real, everybody's hearing about, is this globe chamomile or stink net. That stuff's worthless.
Is that with the yellow blooms?
Yep, that little round yellow flower.
I've got some on my kitchen table. My wife, I picked them for my wife, and they died in a day or two. But
yeah,
they look good for 24 hours.
Yeah, that very aromatic. Not a native plant, and far as we know, nothing's eaten it. It might provide some cover, but it also appears to be competing with native plants and might promote fire, you know. So anyway, not everything you see out there is going to be good quail food.
Yeah.
But the ones they utilize on years like this, those plants are bigger. Like I said, they have more nutrients in them, and they actually make the quail more fertile, and they lay bigger clutches. So you might have a single bird laying more than 12 or 13 eggs this year. You might have her laying 15 to 20 eggs.
Wow.
And so, you know, you're going to, and then they're going to, that family group becomes the core of the new covey, the nucleus of the new covey. And so if you have, you know, theoretically, a 15 covey bird or 15 bird covey, and that covey splits in, you know, there's six pairs in there, and then three satellite males or three males that are unpaired. So those six pairs or those pairs could become could each become a new covey and have, you know, of 20 to 30 birds, because after they raise those chicks, they'll get joined by sometimes by small groups of birds, but also by single cocks and hens will come and join up the covey with that covey and form a new group.
Okay. Well, can I ask a few questions on Gamble's quail right now? That is just
certainly
okay. So you mentioned maybe for our listeners, would you give some synonyms to describe the male species for Gamble's quail? You mentioned the word cocks, and then hens for the female. But what about other names that you could call them, and even nicknames that maybe hunters would use? Like I've heard of the phrase copper tops, or, you know, so maybe describe some more names for our new listeners.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of colloquial names out there, and I tend to use Gamble's quail, they call them, you know, they'll euphemistically desert quail, or any of the species that are found in desert country. So that's scales and Gamble's quail. I used to hear some of the old guys call them top knots, you know, in reference to the plume they have on their head. And I've heard them called Sonoran quail a little bit, because Gamble's quail really are a Sonoran desert bird. They are the Sonoran desert bird, as far as gallinaceous birds. So, you know, you'll hear things like that. We've always used the term cock and hens, but you know, female, male, you know, whatever you want to call them, all works.
What about roosters or drakes? Is that, I mean, I know with ducks, tend to call them drakes and hens.
Yeah, I've heard roosters applied to them, and hens usually is the term for the female. You know, I don't know that I would call them drakes. Drakes are usually reserved for ducks, or at least that's the way I've always heard it used, and have always used it. And of course, we always jokingly call them, you know, bulls and hens, but that's as no foundation in science or even common sense. So you know, there's all those kind of things, but I think all those can fairly accurately or reasonably be applied to them.
Okay. And then what about for just their mortality rate? You mentioned that in a good year of winter rain, like we've had some consecutive years here from October to March, and we even had a good rain last night, March 31st. And, what would you say, kind of an average estimate of, likelihood for how many of these birds are actually going to survive to the season?
Yeah, so the average lifespan for most of these birds is about a year, and so there's an average lifespan, which we see in wild birds, and then there's a potential lifespan, and that potential lifespan comes out sometimes in captive birds, you know. So the birds could theoretically achieve a life span of 10 years or even a little bit greater than that. But that doesn't typically happen in the wild. Most of these birds get eaten by something, die from, you know, some kind of misfortune or something. You know, it's a tough life out there. And so watching chicks around my house, when they bring them in, you know, I'll see mortality on those chicks throughout the season. And so, you know, it's reasonable to expect that before the fall comes around and they've reached, you know, they've nearly reached maturity. Remember, they're not breeding till the following year, but those chicks are virtually indistinguishable from the adult birds by the time you hit October, November.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got to look pretty closely at feathers and molts and things like that, wing coverts, to distinguish age classes on them. By the time they reach outside, I think, and I don't know this is a fact, but I'm guessing the mortality rate's probably somewhere in that, 15 to 30 percentile of chicks don't make it to adulthood. And it might be higher than that, but it's probably not a lot higher than that. The parents do a pretty good job, but it's a dangerous world for those little chicks. I mean, some sparrowhawk nest I was watching, they were heck on gamble quail chicks. They were eating a lot of chicks and bringing them into the nest. And I watched a ground squirrel, a rock squirrel, kill a gamble quail chick in my front yard. I have a water trough out front, and I watched the birds come into that. And this rock squirrel was hanging around, and he grabbed a chick out of a family that came in and just ate it, right there, sat down and ate
A
it.
rock squirrel?
Rock squirrel. So there are
What?
lots of things that eat them.
I mean, I think of roadrunners. I think of owls. I think of snakes. I definitely did not think of a rock squirrel.
Yep. Squirrels are, they're kind of cute and look like they're little sweethearts, but they're little devils, and they'll raid nests and of a lot of different birds, and will eat small lizards, and insects
Wow.
and baby birds, things like that, things they can get a hold of.
Wow.
So they're, they want me too. And what I think a lot of outdoors people don't realize is that it's pretty well documented, grazing elk and deer will, if they come across a bird's nest on the ground, will often eat the eggs or the chicks. That happens with them too. So it's a real mistake to be super absolute. This is an herbivore, this is a carnivore, this kind of thing. It's lines are much fuzzier in reality.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, one last question on Gamble's quail, and then you can add anything that you want to. But the roosters, will they for the Gamble's quail, will they sit on the eggs and kind and will they stay with the hen? So when these guys are out calling right now, and we can see them all throughout the Sonoran Desert, perched up in a Palo Verde or running along and jumping on a fence post or a wall or out in the suburbs of the community, and they're calling, they find their lover, and then do they stick with them and then sit on the eggs, or how long are these gambles male quails sticking with the family?
So the adult bird, the cock bird, the male, sticks around and helps rear that family. Now, what there's some gray areas in here that, again, we're I'm always calling for additional research, and I should say that's taken with a grain of salt, because there are a lot of questions we don't have absolute answers for, and we need to remember that a lot of this gamble quail research, a lot of quail research, period, with the exception of Bob White, that has received a lot of attention in recent years. But a lot of scale quail.
When you say Bob White, do you mean Bob White like in different parts of the country, or do you mean in Arizona?
Both, actually.
Okay.
So the mass Bob White and Bob Whites in Texas and throughout the Southeast have received a lot of attention in recent years, because sadly, Bob White went from one of the most widely distributed common birds in North America, not just the United States, in North America, to in the United States being pretty
What?
uncommon in most of
Right,
their
right.
historic habitats.
Yeah.
And there's lots and lots of reasons for
And
that.
you can't even hunt Bob White here in Arizona, am I right?
No, yeah. So our Bob White, mass Bob White,
Buenos Aires
basically,
Wildlife
yeah,
Refuge or something like that?
right, basically went extinct. Or was extirpated is a proper word, which is locally extinct. So it was extirpated from Arizona. Then it disappeared from Sonora, Mexico. And so the only birds there were, it was functionally extinct at one point. There were no birds that we know of in the wild anywhere in Mexico or the United States. And only birds that were extant were captive birds that were used in these breeding programs that was having very poor success at getting birds to persist in the field. So they would rear and put them out, and they would not make it through the season. They weren't surviving long enough to reproduce. And they hit upon, it was a brilliant idea, this surrogate program where they're rearing chicks or hatching chicks and then giving them to Texas Bob White. I believe they're from Texas. Anyway, wild Bob Whites to rear. And all of a sudden, the program, who was languishing for 40 plus years, is had a, done a 180. And if you hunted quail in Arizona, you probably saw the warnings about if you're hunting down there along the border around Buenos Aires, you know, watch out for mass Bob Whites, because they've now, numbers have grown to where they've actually moved off the refuge in some places, and they're still federally protected. They're an endangered species.
Yeah, I was hunting down there with my daughter, and I was thinking, boy, that would be the wrong bird to shoot. You'd be in big trouble with that boy.
Yeah, it would be the wrong bird to shoot. The great news about that, even though it's a little bit difficult for hunters right now, is that if this continues, and let's hope it does, you know, in the not too distant future, you might have the opportunity to hunt mass Bob Whites for the first time in nearly 100 years.
Wow. Yeah. And so that's a trap. I mean, I know that as a kid growing up, I went on one wild bird quail hunt as a kid, but I hear stories from my wife, how her father and her grandfather, they were Methodist ministers in Little Rock, Arkansas, and they traveled all around Arkansas to these little church and farm towns, and they hunted with their parishioners, and they quail hunted Bob White, and they were in abundance, you know. And as a kid, I grew up, and we went on one hunt, and that was it, and it was over. And I remember my dad saying, it's not worth hunting them. And back behind our, we have a ranch out in west of Little Rock, and we still go horseback riding out there, and we'll flush a small little covey of Bob Whites here and there. And, but boy, they are far and few in between, you know?
Yes. Like your, wife's parents, my dad grew up hunting Bob Whites in eastern Oklahoma. And then, you know, when he was transferred out here to Williams Air Force Base, you know, it was natural that he'd start quail hunting out here. And so, yeah, that it can still be difficult to find decent Bob White hunting over much of the United States. And certainly many of their historic haunts, they're just not there anymore. And so the mass Bob White suffered a similar problems. And so this success, you know, in this reintroduction program is laudable. It's a wonderful thing to have happening, and very, very exciting. And what a beautiful bird. I mean, they're just fantastic.
Well, we shoot a lot of them. I've got a game bird license. I'm grateful Arizona Game and Fish has worked with me with Arizona Quail Today to do a game bird license. And so I have the privilege to be able to buy Bob Whites, and, they don't flush near as fast as those wild gambles, or scalies or merns, but it's a fun bird to shoot for training, and still a good bird to eat. They're a pretty good sized bird.
They are. They're great. And you know, your opinion of them will change when you get into wild Bob Whites. And so they're plenty sporty. Yeah. They're a wonderful game bird and a beautiful animal. And so they really, really are a lot of fun to hunt. And I've only done it a few times, but I'm looking forward to doing more of it in the future.
Well, one of the guys that was an early inspiration for me was Darrell Smith. He's the podcast guy for the Gun Dog Notebook. And when I first got into, you know, looking at just kind of educating myself with, you know, bird dogs and all this stuff, I started attending the Arizona Pointing Dog Club and listening in on the Gun Dog Notebook. And I talked to Darrell one time about Bob White. And he said that, I mean, there is some really good numbers of Bob White quail in Georgia. And he's out hunting all the time, chasing Bob Whites. They do a lot. He's turned into quite the trial dog guy, but there's quite a history and a legacy of Bob White quail hunting down there in Georgia, from what I hear.
Yeah, I know some people that work for the wildlife department there, And one of the things they've been working really hard on is recovering the habitat and shoring up those bobwhite populations. And so on a lot of their wildlife areas, they've brought them back just through good management. And mind you, this conversation took place, heaven's sakes, 8 years ago, or longer, when they were doing that. And I was out in Georgia doing some stuff, and I was talking to the biologist out there. And so there's a lot of things that can be done to help all of these or many of these birds that are struggling. And bobwhite is just one that's just gotten a lot of attention, and thank goodness it has, because they are recovering in some areas.
Yeah. And these birds that you described down in the Buenos Aires refuge and whatnot, is it a very, very much common markings as the traditional bobwhite you'd find out in Georgia, Oklahoma, Arkansas?
You wouldn't be able to tell the hens apart.
Okay, but you could see the similarities between the cocks.
They actually look very different, and so the back of the cock bird, so the wings, the wing coverts, and the scapularies and all of those feather groups on the back look very much the same as bobwhites everywhere. But the breast of the bird tends to be a rufous, kind of a rusty red color, and then they've got a black head.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. I remember, I want to say either I saw them in, I don't know if it was Arizona Game and Fish, something on their website, or if it was in one of the books, David Brown's book or your book. But I remember seeing that they have more black markings, do they not?
Yeah, they like I said, the head's almost entirely black. Yeah. And so there's one down in that is very similarly marked. I think the subspecies is Coiloios, and it's out of Oaxaca. And that bird looks almost identical to our mashed bobwhite. It's a very, very different bird. If you're looking at the chicks and again the hens, you're not going to notice any difference between a Texas bobwhite or Georgia bobwhite or one from Michigan for that matter.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I know we kind of got sidetracked here, but kind of the mentality I've had with this podcasting business is I don't like the idea of just trying to keep it at 45 minutes or 60 minutes, but just let the conversation roll. And if it's good conversation, we'll keep moving. But I know that for time's sake, we probably need to move on. So is there anything else you want to add to Gamble's Quail before we start talking about scalies? And I can integrate a question that came in related to scalies. But anything else on Gamble's Quail that you just want to note, what's happening right now biologically? And then maybe let's just toss in there, what we might be able to expect in this upcoming season for Gamble's.
Sure. So, I think one of the interesting things is that, Gamble's Quail is actually the smallest of our quail in Arizona. and biologically, just watch the birds. When you see them, pay attention to what they're doing and what's going on, and watch for those chicks. One of the things I see pretty commonly with chicks that just seems to be a little meaningless, anomalous thing is that I often see white patches on the wings of chicks, and they lose that pretty early in the molts. But when they're small, that seems to be a thing that is not uncommon. And I don't see that in the chicks of other birds, but admittedly, I don't get to see tons of scale quail chicks or Mearns quail chicks. So just a goofy little deal out there with them. But this rain and that we're having now, that's not only going to provide cover for those chicks, but it's also going to provide lots of insects and protein, super important for those growing birds. So this is a great, long as we're getting this rain and it keeps coming, and it keeps moist out. We should have a high survivorship of those chicks and being see a nice uptick in the number of birds next year. What we really, really want is three wet winters back to back. And I'm almost willing to bet the house that that will not happen, because since this drought started 30 plus years ago, two out of three winters are dry, and we can't seem to get a string of wet winters going. And that's really when we're going to see those gamble quail populations surge, is because they've been pretty low. And this was our first year of a jump in numbers.
Well, but nonetheless, we ought to see some better numbers than we did last year. Is that correct?
We should. Yeah. No, we should. We should see it go up. And so, you know, you just can't go to fantastic from low to fantastic in 1 year. For all the old timers out there that have been hunting birds in Arizona, the last really good gambles quail year we saw, where it was really spectacular, was 93. 92, 93. And we've just not had those conditions since then.
Yeah. You know, and I hunt with a bunch of those guys, and it's like, it reminds me of the talks that we had with Arkansas duck hunting too. You know, I mean, it was the '90s too. I don't know if it was just a wetter season in the United States or across the South and the Southwest, but in the '90s, those were the last years of like the heydays of duck season. I'm talking, I mean, I could tell story after story of, as a young kid, just the entire sky covered with ducks and geese. And I mean, it's just a epic experience. And now my dad and brothers call and tell me, oh, we shot three, you know, we shot a couple of woodies and some gadwalds, you know. So it really, I know the there, but for my generation moving out here, you know, and I was talking about this with Matt Russell, it's like, man, yeah, I mean, this is great gambles hunting, this that we had this last season. It was just a great season, you know.
Yeah, it was certainly, since the drought started, it one of the better years.
Yeah.
And, you know, picking up, you know, so, yeah. And so, you know, keep your fingers crossed. It could get a lot better. And so, you know, they've got that potential if we can just get the break.
Yeah. Okay. So let's jump in, since we're on desert birds. Let's talk scaled quail. What do you think? What is happening right now biologically with the scaled quail?
So, you know, going back to the pairing, scale quail are also paired up this time of year. So the interesting thing of our four species of native quail, all
when you say the four species, let's name them out just as a refresher.
So gambles quail, scale quail, Montezuma or Mearns quail, and mass bob whites.
Okay.
So of those four species of native quail that we have here, the three of those, the gambles quail, the scale quail, and the Montezuma quail, all pair in the late winter, and so, or early spring. So so like gambles quail, scale quail are doing the same thing. But they're really not going to be doing much breeding until the onset of the summer rainy season. Even though they're paired, they'll put breeding off. Scale quail kind of split the difference in respect to gambles quail and Mearns quail. So gambles quail are winter rain. Montezuma quail or Mearns are summer rain. Scale quail kind of are a little bit of both, and so with a heavier emphasis on summer rains. So they, our scale quail do best if we've got a nice summer, or you know, decent winter rains followed by a good summer rainy season.
Yeah. And as far as population sizes, would you say in this order, as most populated, you know, the most birds, gambles number one, as far as how many birds are in the state, scaled quail number two and Mearns number three?
Yeah, and so there's, but the, you know, it's a little more nuanced than that. So I would agree with that, but it has to do with habitat distribution, and then fecundity, or you know, the covey sizes and stuff like that. So, so scale quail have a good footprint. They're predominantly a Chihuahuan desert bird, desert grassland Chihuahuan desert bird, and so. You know, they go all the way up near St. John's in eastern Arizona, so three quarters of the way up the state, and then
Wow, and that's pretty high elevation. I mean, I was up
it
there not too long ago. That's like the White Mountains area.
It's just on the big, it's on the big central plateau there. Yeah, you're right. So yeah, they get up there, and then you know, but they're most abundant in the southeastern corner of the state there, where you get into the more classic habitat for them. And so they, you know, so they're, like I said, they're kind of splitting the difference. And so if we, even though we've had decent winter rain, if our summer rains are a big kaput like they were this last year, we're probably not gonna see much in reproduction on the birds. They have, you know, they're the second largest of our birds, or the third largest. I can't remember what order they're in. And they, you know, both sexes very similar. And you will start seeing the males do the advertising call here as we go into, you know, into June, July. Kind of that time frame is when they're going to start out, and it's really going to be driven chiefly by those monsoon rains that we get that time of year. And then they're going to select similar nesting sites, and usually in a clump of grass or under overhanging grass or something similar to that. And then the average clutch size is going to be very similar to the gambel's quail. And so those birds will they'll rear those birds. Both parents stick around to rear the chicks, and they get to they get up to reach maturity about 22 weeks, or adult size more or less.
All right. And these birds right now, the scaled quail, they are pairing up right now. And are they mating right now, or are they
No,
just pairing up?
they're like the Montezuma quail. They're just paired, and
Okay,
so
so
yep, and just like the gambler's quail paired earlier and weren't mating, they're just paired.
so so they have a longer courtship, if you will, than like the gambles, because the gambles are going to be mating pretty soon, are they not?
They're mating now, yeah, and
Okay.
so and have been, and so when you hear the calling start. Like with like you're hearing with the gambles right now, that's that mating's commenced, and so the mating season is commenced, and so the scale quail aren't going to call until, again, till into June, on into July, as those summer rains start to come in.
Okay. And then will they operate like I like to call them roosters, but what will the male scaled quail, will they operate behaviorally much like the gambles or no?
Very, very similar. And so you remember they're in the same genus. They're in that genus Calpepla. And so they're very, very, very closely related. And so the California quail, the gambler's quail, and the scale quail are all sister taxon. They're all very, very, very closely related. They're first cousins, right? So they're all in that same genus. And then Montezuma's quail is way out in left field. That's a whole different critter. So yeah, so the behavior, those three species are all going to be very similar. Clutch sizes are similar. Parenting is similar. Nest site selection is similar. All very much in line with each other.
And for our listeners, clarify a little bit of the difference. What is the nuances between clutch and covey?
Yeah, so clutch size is the number of eggs laid. And the and so and that varies. And so on a bad year, really bad year, they may lay five eggs. And on a really good year, that same bird may lay upwards of 20 eggs. And so that's that's the clutch size. And so, and then the brood size is what's hatched. Because oftentimes, you know, you'll have a dud in there or something, or an egg won't hatch, or eggs will get depredated by, you know, a raccoon or skunk or something like that. And so the clutch size is or the number of eggs, the brood size is the number of chicks you've got there. And then the covey is the number of birds that are in the social group that that the pairs come from. And so the family group, which would be the brood size plus the parents, that is joined at the end of the season as we go into the fall by unsuccessful birds that weren't didn't raise broods, and or single males that were never got paired. They'll join those coveys, and then that or join that family group, and then that forms the covey.
Yeah, I think I think probably most listeners would think that a covey is a rooster and a hen and all the babies, but that's really not the case.
No, that's a family group.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's like,
that's the extended family.
Yeah. And well, it's not even the extended family. That's the immediate family. The covey is, you know, could be brothers and sisters and other related birds, but, and totally unrelated birds. Turkeys do very much the same thing. Grouse are similar in many ways, some species of grouse. And so this is a fairly common model for gallinaceous birds.
So it'd be more like a covey is almost like a community of people. Would that be fair to say? Like you got perhaps the mother and the father and the kids, and then you've got a neighbor nearby, and then you've got another single or another small covey or another small, you know, clutch. And
So that's a pretty good way. Think of it this way. You're taking your family on the vacation, right? And you've got six kids. And so mom, dad, and the kids all get on a bus. And on that bus, a bunch of other people are coming in to ride the bus. That's the covey. So you've got the family group that gets on the bus, and then all these other people come on the bus, and that forms a group, and that's what the covey is.
Wow. But at the nucleus of the covey, is it not the rooster and the hen
is the family group?
Yeah, okay.
That's right.
So curiosity be, you know, like I'm just kind of moving around here, but curiosity be like, you know, like when coveys are out, do they not have like sentries or whatever, where when you're hunting, they have kind of like these scouts that kind of watch out?
Yeah. So that I don't know the exact dynamics of that, but that role I believe is played by various birds in the covey.
Yeah.
And or the family group. And so I often see the male bird up there on what we call sentry.
Yeah.
That's but usually a high point, and he's watching over the other birds as they move across the ground. And I do not know if it's the same bird every time when there's a covey, or if it's one bird assumes that all the time. I really don't know the answer to that. But I assume that, or I should say, I presume that in a family group, that role is generally probably assumed by the father or the male parent. And then once you get into a covey, I think there's probably any of a number of individuals that could potentially assume that role.
Wow. That's pretty fascinating. Well, all right. On scaled quail, is there anything else that you'd like to add to that for the listeners that are kind of trying to understand what's happening right now for scaled quail? I think I'm going to check my questions here that came in, but go ahead.
Yeah. So scaled quail, you know, the jury's still out. We're, you know, things are set for a good gamble quail year, or things to improve for gamble quail. Scaled quail, it could go south if we end up with a really bad winter, or I mean bad summer. But things are looking good. They're moving in the right direction, but it's still anybody's game at this point. And so that that is, you know, anything can happen. Scale quail, you know, have suffered some declines in the state, usually habitat related. And so they really like those open grasslands. And once it gets too brushy and too scrubby, then it becomes gamble quail habitat. You know, it's really important to maintain those Chihuahuan desert grasslands, those desert grassland habitats, that big open stuff with very few shrubs and trees on it for scale quail.
That's great. Well, one of the questions that came in from Robert in Phoenix, he asked a question. He said something along the lines of, I'm going off memory. He messaged me on Instagram and just said something along the lines of, you know, I've hunted a lot of gambles quail, but I really want to get into scaled quail. Can you describe some of the habitat and some of the behavior for scaled quail? And I think you've touched on that a little bit, but do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, so scale quail, you want a typical scale quail habitat is a high grassland component with shrubs and trees at a minimum. So you want more grass than you want those other things. You can have brushy draws and, you know, and mesquite line channels, but you really want those slopes and the uplands to be mostly grass. And there can be some other things in there, but you really want a lot of grass. You know, their habits are very similar to other birds. They get up in the morning, you know, right around sunrise, and they start moving out to feed. They have a distinctive call, which if you learn that, that's helpful. And it's kind of a chuck chuck call. You can even with that Lohmann's quail call, you can do a pretty good imitation of it. Otherwise, behavior is very similar to the other birds. You know, they'll flush. They tend to flush a little bit more wild, and they'll often run a good bit. But when they hold, they'll often hold much tighter than gambles quail. I mean, to the extent where you're kicking shrubs and bushes to get them to flush.
Yeah.
So they can hold incredibly tight once you get them split up. But all the desert bird hunting is about splitting up the covey and chasing singles. And so very different than merged quail hunting.
Yeah, I think that's something to note is that, you know, putting pressure on those desert birds is pretty imperative to get the covey to kind of move around.
You want to split them up, and you want that covey to, when you, on any of those desert birds, when you see them flush, you want a big fan of birds going out. You don't want a little tight wad of birds going out straight in front of you. If they land and they can see each other, they're generally going to run. And so you want them to, the cover to be heavy enough to where they hit the ground, they look over there and say, oh, gee, you know, George isn't here, you know, and then they're going to stick for you. But otherwise, if, like those open creosote flats, that's pretty much just a waste of time chasing quail in that.
That's funny. We said the same thing in the last episode was just, you know, I mean, those birds might find some cover there from hawks or whatever, but it's a worthless endeavor for the hunter to try to chase birds through there.
They'll never slow down.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk. And Robert, I'm sorry we didn't dive more into that, but I would suggest, would you not, Randy, just pick up a book and or, you know, study a little bit more and learn a little bit more through some of the descriptions on habitat and whatnot. And generally speaking, I mean, rough areas of locations for those scaled quail, southeast Arizona. And I know within Arizona quail today, we try to avoid giving, you know, pinpoints, and everybody messages me every year, more than two dozen messages. Can you please send me a location, you know? And I don't do that. But anything you'd suggest for just general rough areas for,
there's scale quail in those grassy portions of, Greenlee, Cochise, they get into Pima County and into some sections of Pinal. But predominantly the southeastern corner of the state is going to be your best scale quail habitat. Again, you know, they do make it up on in St. John's and stuff. And so you can, and I'm not plugging my book. I just am familiar with what I put in there. You know, there's a range map in there, and you can see the kinds of parts of the state. Gabe Brown has an excellent range map in his, and so there's a Webb Parton did a nice book that I think is out of print called A Wingshooter's Guide to Arizona, and that
I
has some
think I
good
got
state
that book,
information.
yeah.
Yep, that's a, it's well done. Webb's a excellent bird guy. He used to guide and stuff. So yeah, there's some good resources, and you can find that stuff. But don't, you know, if it looks like great Gambel's quail habitat, it's probably not good scale quail habitat. You
Wow.
find them together oftentimes, but Gambel quail are a shrubland. You know, we would call it desert scrub, and scale quail are a grassland species. So
Yeah.
those are the difference between those birds.
Scrub versus grassland. And
Yep.
as far as like ease for the hunter, probably the grasslands are easier to walk, am I right, than the
Well, they
shrubland?
can be. If you get in that malapai stuff, holy cats, you know, that's ankle breaking stuff. And we are hunting up in some of that stuff, and my friend just finally said, "I'm done. I'm." And there were birds. I was not willing to leave, and he had to drag me out of there. But he was just, you know, he it can be difficult walking in that stuff. If you get into the nice bajadas and the mesas and stuff without that malapai rock, you could. It's a joy. It's great dog country, and it's a pleasure to walk.
Yeah, I can imagine. And they go up to 7,000 feet, is that not right?
Yeah, they'll get up there. So there were I remember having a conversation with Dave Brown about him collecting some birds up near Springerville.
That's
And
way high up there.
yeah, and so you can get up there, you know. So yeah, those birds, you know, it's the habitat, and different environmental conditions may allow that habitat exist at different elevations. Oh, did I lose you there?
Still okay, there we are. Sorry about that.
Right.
Well, let's talk about Mearns quail for a moment. So, what's happening biologically with the Mearns quail?
Okay, so likewise, they paired up, and you know those, and they are just gonna stay in a loose covey until we get closer or here for several more weeks, and then they're gonna start breaking up the pairs, and single males will start calling with the onset of the summer rain, and they've got a real distinctive buzz call that they don't get from a perch; they give it on the ground. So you very seldom ever see them doing it. Scale quail will get up on yuccas and other high points and do advertisement calls, just like gamble quail like to be up on a perch. But merge quail, I have tried and tried to see him doing the call, and I've been right,
Wow.
you know, a few yards away from him, and I can't ever see him doing it. But it's a kind of a descending. I'll do a bad imitation of it, because. Bzz, bzz. Call like that, and again, typically given from grassy, you know, tussocks and other concealed spots. But those males will call largely futilely, trying to attract unpaired mates, and so all scale quail numbers are all about summer rainfall, and the one bright spot about this drought is in these 30 plus years, we've had some of the best Mearns quail hunting I've ever seen during these years. So the rainfall pattern has shifted from a predominantly winter rainfall pattern, or I should say a more equally distributed 50-50 rainfall pattern, to predominantly a summer rainfall pattern in this drought. And so if we get good summer rains, we'll see an increase in Mearns quail numbers. We should see an uptick. Now, it's not going to be a great big one, because we had a really bad summer last year. So you're going to need, again, about 3 years back to back to have those numbers really, really get impressive. But you should see, if again, rain provided, an uptick in numbers. But the jury's still out on that. Yeah. We have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, and for those of you listening in for the first time, you could go back and listen to episode one. But Matt Russell, the guy's put on more, roughly 1,000 miles hunting this quail this last season, and then roughly 2,000 miles with his dogs. And his response was, man, the merge numbers were just low. And
they were
just low. And as well, I mentioned it to you on a phone call just the other day. It appears that we are in this El Nino pattern where the we're just getting some decent winter rains and some bad summer rains. Do you think that's going to continue?
It's hard to say. You know, you'll have to watch your National Weather Service for all that stuff. El Nino is a current, basically, that moves cold water further north, I believe it is, or it's vice versa anyway, and it affects the rainfall pattern. El Nino brings us winter rains. La Nina usually are summer rains. Or you can have El Nino neutral years where you've got a 50-50 chance of either thing happening. So, I'm not a meteorologist, I'm not even going to get deep into that because I would just be, afraid of giving any inaccuracies. I can tell you that it's very uncommon to have two wet seasons back to back. So if we have a wet winter, it's very unusual to have a wet summer. And we're having a pretty darn good winter now. And so I would guess the summer's going to be dry.
Yeah.
A few years back, we had three wet seasons back to back, which was super unusual. We had a wet winter, a wet summer, and a wet winter. And so that was 3, 4, 5 years back, and that happened, and very, very uncommon. But we'll see what happens here. I'm not expecting great things out of the summer rainy season. Not for lack of desire. It's just more fear.
Yeah.
And love on my part.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that pretty much covers it. Anything else you want to add to kind of the three different species we've talked about, gamble, scaled, and merns? There's been kind of a common theme of that I've communicated is this kind of just hunters need to be very, very mindful of the merns quail, that it's just not been good numbers of birds. And we got a lot of an increased number of out-of-state hunters and who like to utilize Arizona. And so, but gamble's quail looks like it's going to be another great year. Scaled quail, perhaps a little bit better. And the jury's a little out for that. But merns quail as well just is not even starting with a good number of carryover.
No, they're at a low point. And, I didn't even hunt merns quail this year. I generally, when the numbers get real low, I just don't do it. I think they get a lot of pressure from people chasing them. And when gamble's quail is good and scale quail, I'll focus on those birds. When numbers go back up, I'll be out there with the dogs. Merns quail, again, are very, very, very different birds. And so they're in a whole different group of quail, as are the Bob Whites. And so this is a tropical species at its northern distributional limits. And they do have a pretty significant range, but only a small portion of the area of the habitat is optimal range. So those birds are found all the way up into the White Mountains, near Springerville and Big Lake and on up to 9,000 feet. Those birds are there, but their numbers are just fairly low. And where you see them most, they're an oak woodland, oak savanna bird. So need a good grass component with about 30% cover, generally oaks, and that's the best habitat for those birds.
Yeah. And I just didn't get out and hunt those birds as much just because they're a little far for me and their numbers are low anyway, and able to bag plenty of gamble's quail around here. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit. We're going to open it up for some questions. Nate is our producer, and he's new to Arizona quail hunting and represents a growing demographic of young hunters that are listening in. And we've got his dog back here whining away because he sees my daughter running around inside, and he's just a playful pointer. But despite that, we want to try to answer some of these questions. So, Nate, why don't you jump in and talk to us about some of your thoughts and feedback about the interview that you've been listening to.
Hey, Randy. Nate here. I took a lot of notes and really insightful stuff on the different species of quail. And so first question I had, and I've been referencing your book and just looking at it, which – You did an amazing job with the different sections and tabs and putting the maps. But anyways, I'll jump to my question. And I saw that you put here, I'm going to look at the book actually real quick for my question. For the genus name, I think here it's Calypepla for the scaled quail and the gambles quail. So what makes a quail a quail? I don't know if that's too broad of a question, but you know, they looked at, when I was a kid growing up, I thought all quails were just the gambles quail, because I live in the Phoenix area, and that's predominantly the bird you see running around with its little feather on top. And so I thought that was the only quail that existed, but looking here, there's, you know, I think you have six listed, but you know, there's four majorly in Arizona. And so what makes a quail a quail?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, so quail are in the group of birds known as gallinaceous birds, and gallinaceous birds are referred to generally as chicken-like birds. So quails are spend most of their life on the ground, and they have these behaviors that are seen widely in gallinaceous birds. So this pairing, you know, that we're talking about early on, pairing both parents sticking around and raising the chicks and stuff, that's common in a lot of gallinaceous birds. But turkeys are gallinaceous birds, and those toms are nowhere to be seen when the work of raising those young are, you know, come up. And so they fertilize the hens, and then they're off playing cards or heaven knows whatever they're doing. Anyway, they're out and about. So these, as far as quails in the gallinaceous birds, I don't know the exact technical designation, but I suspect it's somewhat arbitrary. So the difference between a dove and a pigeon is totally contrived. And so it references size in a vague sense, but there's no size limit. But when a dove becomes a pigeon, it goes back and forth all over the place. And so I suspect with quails, it's a broad term used, and included in things that are called quails are different forest quail and a group of birds called wood quail and tree quails. And they are all share in common that they are predominantly ground birds, not always, but predominantly ground birds, and they share the same body structure, kind of short, rotund, stubby birds, and with modest size heads. Their heads are pretty good size for the birds, actually, and short tails. And that's kind of what defines quails in the broadest sense. Again, there may be some technical sense that I'm not aware of.
That's good. That's interesting. Nate, what's another question you got there, bud?
Okay, so you touched a little bit on this, you know, through describing each species, but I've only hunted gambles quail. So, you know, for a new hunter or somebody kind of looking to get out in other parts of Arizona, how is hunting merns and scaly quail different than hunting gambles, if at all?
Yeah, I would say that gambles quail and scale quail have the most in common as far as hunting techniques. You know, you get out there, If you don't have a dog, you look for appropriate habitat, and you hike to habitats where you hope to find them. Those birds are gonna flush, at 30 yards or so, and they're very vocal. Both scale quail and gamble quail call a lot, so they're much easier to find than Mearns quail, which almost requires a dog. I have some friends that have hunted them without dogs, but man, that's, you got to have high bird numbers and do a lot of legwork. So Montezuma or Mearns quail, they hold incredibly tight, and usually when the dog goes on points, those birds are right under their nose oftentimes, and you are going to nearly step on the birds before they get up. So most of your flushes are 20 yards and under, and that's why you can use a 410 on them, because your shots are all very close typically. And whereas gamble quail, scale quail, a typical shot's going to be 30 yards or even better oftentimes. They will hold tight, but a lot of birds will flush wild, and so you need a little bit heavier shot and a little bit heavier loads to bring them down. Mearns quail are in these beautiful oak woodlands in southern Arizona, and you're in much more open country for the other two birds. Scale quail, these big grassland expanses, often you can see miles and miles in direction. In gambles quail, you're going to still see the horizon, but there may be a lot of saguaros and palaverdes and ironwoods and creosotes and bursages and a bunch of other plants in there with them. So all different experiences.
Great, thank you. And then you kind of already touched on this, but what would be the ideal, for somebody trying to get out and start hunting? And I'm specifically talking about gambles quail. What would be the ideal cover or habitat environment you're looking for when looking for gambles quail? Maybe it's a specific kind of tree or plant or bush, anything, that's kind of pretty iconic to, if you see that quail could be around.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it depends partially on what part of the state you're in. And so if you're hunting north of Phoenix, if you're going up in that area, you might be hunting in chaparral, which is going to have scrub oaks and down in the creek bottoms, there's going to be sycamores and cottonwoods and ashes and alders. But a lot of the cover might be manzanita or like I said, scrub oak, turbinella. You might have other bushes like buckbrush and things like that in there. And then usually there'll be a pretty decent grass cover. And these are going to be summer grasses. And so when you're hunting, they'll be dry. Matter of fact, that's true for scale quail too. Most of our grasses and grasslands are summer rain grasses. But it doesn't have to be necessarily thick. The cover can be in the form of shrubs for them, but grasses are also nice to have too. And oftentimes the country's going to be cut by draws or washes, or you might have steep hills or mountainsides and slopes, and so a variety of stuff. And if you're hunting lower, like I live out around Apache Junction, if I was hunting Mearns quail here or out down towards Tucson, I'm going to be hunting in Arizona upland, and the cover there is going to be buckwheat or bur sage mixed with a few other shrubs, and there's going to be some grasses mixed in there, but they're going to be bunch grasses and some pretty thin on the ground annual grasses, and then there'll be saguaros and palaverdes and ironwoods, and then in the riparian areas, I'm not going to be seeing those big cottonwoods, although there'll be some of those if you get over towards the San Pedro or something. What you're going to see is hackberries and catclaw and things like that. So, like I said, it depends on where you're chasing them at, what the habitat looks like.
Yeah, that's great. And I've noticed some of that already, and you've described some of the trees and bushes in the area that I've hunted as well. Mainly Phoenix area. I wouldn't say obviously in the city, but out east by, north, east of Phoenix, north of Phoenix a little bit. But anyways, last question is, and you touched on this, off season, but how does the weather affect quail activity? So I know you said between the months of, if I'm not mistaken, October and March, rainfall is going to determine how, you know, they mate in that upcoming season. But let's say it's the middle of the season, you know, November, December. How is rain, let's say it rained the day before, or it might be raining the day of, how does rainfall or other, you know, weather activity, whether it's a drought, or how is that going to affect quail activity throughout the day?
That's a fantastic question, and it's a really insightful one and an important one. So first of all, off on really windy days, I don't bother quail hunting, or if I try it, it's usually largely futile. You can't hear the birds flush, can't hear the birds call. They're going to be holed up in on leeward side of hills and down in bottoms, and so they might be a little easier to find. I don't think they are really, but you know, you just can't do much with them. And on the other hand, other weather days like rainfall, they do not like the rain. They do not like moving around in the rain. They don't want to be wet. So if it's raining hard, you know, and hard enough to where you don't want to be out in it, they don't want to be out in it. And so they'll be holed up again in washes or some kind of cover. Generally, for the most part, it's going to be in a thicket of some sort. And for most of gambles quail habitats, it's going to be along a drainage. With a light rain, they're going to get up and move if it's a really light, misty rain. But they still aren't happy. And oftentimes, they'll hold a little bit better in that kind of, they don't tend to be as vocal, but they'll hold a little bit better in those conditions. And then when it snows, I used to call in sick to work. You know, if I had a snow in the desert, I was going bird hunting. And so many of these birds live their whole life and don't see a snow in the low elevations. And so those birds will hold remarkably tight, and they're just confused for a while. And so you can get into some really great hunting, and in addition to great sending conditions when you've got snow on the ground for those birds. And so especially the first day that is snowing in the lowlands, like in the Palaverry Saguaro deserts, if you get into some of that, that can be really spectacular. But bright, hot, and sunny, you know, they're going to follow their typical activity, which is out in the morning feeding, and then middle of the day they're going to be loafing somewhere, generally in a thick spot along a wash or in a draw. And then in the afternoon, around 3-ish or a little bit before, they're going to get out and feed a while. And then they're going to move to roost in the evening, which again is going to be in a thick spot, typically off the ground. They don't roost on the ground. They're going to roost in a hackberry or a big cat claw or some kind of other big shrub, a sumac, something like that, that they can get up in. Wolfberries are good for them to roost in. They like those. And so they're going to be up off the ground in some kind of thick cover. And so when there's that daily cycle, and then there's that seasonal cycle. When late in the season, and Ryan told me about one of his experiences, you can get these super coveys forming where if we've had good winter rains and you get these big areas of green up, it's not terribly uncommon to find really large coveys of birds in these areas. And you know, I've seen well over 200 birds get up at a time. You know, and this, mind you, this was a long time ago, but that would be, and that's what you're seeing, is several coveys of birds coming together and congregating in a feeding area, and then they're getting up as one when you flush them. And we call those super coveys. And you get those super coveys forming when you've got these really optimal conditions and a lot of green feed, and birds are moving into those areas to feed, which is in preparation for breeding, bringing them into breeding condition. And sometimes you'll see this with Mearns quail. I've seen, you know, 30, 40 birds get up, you know, just one right after another. And that was 6 or 7 coveys of birds, you know, that were all in an area feeding when conditions were really optimal.
Yeah, that's really great. Nate, thanks so much for asking those questions. Any comments in closing?
There was a ton of information. I'm definitely going to read the book. Hopefully I can borrow it from Ryan and just get some more, you know, species-specific details on each quail and just learn about them. I was just reading it as you were talking, and there's a ton of information out there. So Thank you for writing that, and thank you for sharing and answering my questions.
My pleasure, and thanks for the kind words about the book.
Yeah. Well, Randy, thanks as always. It's always a great talking with you. For you listeners listening in, again, the book that you want to pick up is Hunting Small Game in Arizona. Randy Babb is the author, and you can find more information about that on Arizona Game and Fish Commission's website and pick that up as a copy. It's definitely a must-have for Arizona hunting small game. And it's a great, great resource for quail, as it's really the only colored picture book that I've seen so far that I've really appreciated for hunting quail in Arizona, and it's a great one. So great job on that, Randy, and thanks for all the super insight and whatnot. So any closing comments to the listeners, Randy?
No, just get out there after him. I'm always happy to talk birds. Thanks for having me on. And let's hope we see those numbers pick up a little bit and that we get some summer rains. That would be wonderful.
Great. And I'd love to have you back like we did last year for a bird hunter's brunch. And then we do a forecast for the upcoming season once we allow these monsoon rains kind of to start to settle in. And we can do an early forecast. So I'd love to get reconnected to you and then have some more discussion on that.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I'm in.
All right. And thanks for listening again to Arizona Quail Today. This is Ryan Rice, and I'm with Nate Eichstraight for another episode on Arizona Quail Today. For more educational content, you can visit our website, azquailtoday.com. And for more information and whatnot, you can check us out on Instagram. Thanks for being a part, and stay tuned and make sure to get outside.
Thanks for listening in. To help further our work, please consider making a tax-deductible gift. Visit us online at azquailtoday.com and be sure to follow us on social media for the latest information and updates. Till then, remember to get outside.